May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Beverly Bove, and I represent Lori Bromstead de Turck in this appeal. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Lori Bromstead de Turck was in a horrible auto collision in May of 2007, nearly 2 years ago. She sustained serious and permanent injuries, the most lingering of which is a very bad left leg injury. She was hit by an underinsured drunk driver head-on within 3 miles of her home. At the time of the collision, Lori and her husband, Scott de Turck, owned 3 vehicles in the household. Each vehicle was insured by a separate policy issued by State Farm, the carrier. Each policy included underinsured motorist coverage in the single policy limit of $100,000 each. The tortfeasor tendered the $15,000 policy limit, thereby triggering the underinsured coverage that the de Turks owned. We filed a declaratory judgment action on behalf of Lori Bromstead de Turck, seeking access to all 3 of those underinsured motorist policies. State Farm defended the action with a motion to dismiss, claiming that the underinsured motorist statute, subsection 3902C, applied to prohibit the post-triggering stacking of her UIM coverage. State Farm tendered the first policy, and the Superior Court dismissed the action for our access to the other 2 policies. The question in this case is, does 3902C apply to post-triggering stacking for the purposes of coverage, or was that subsection of the statute intended to apply only to the triggering issues under the underinsured motorist coverage? To take that one step further, if 3902C is held to apply to prohibit stacking in the Bromstead de Turck case, it is my position that it creates a subclass of insureds, namely the policyholder who lives in the household, who could not recover under that insurance when another class could. For example, if there was a passenger in Bromstead de Turck's car who was an unrelated passenger and had to have access to those 3 policies, that passenger could stack for total coverage, obviously, once the policy was triggered.
Before you get to the statutory argument, let's focus first on the policy. Does the policy itself, each policy, prohibit the stacking?
The first position, Your Honor, is State Farm has taken the position that the language is the same in all 3 policies. I've seen the language in 1 policy. I don't know that I have the other 2, but I'm taking State Farm's word that the language is the same in all 3, and they take the position that that policy language prohibits the stacking.
Well, what is your position?
My position is that strictly on the policy language is void as a matter of law based on Deptula versus Horace Mann, this court's decision in 2004.
So you assume, for your argument, that it does prohibit the stacking, but it violates public policy?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me ask another preliminary question. Does the record reflect what the relative cost of the insurance was for 3 State Farm policies on the 3 vehicles as opposed to the insured buying and insuring 1 car from State Farm, 1 car from Nationwide, 1 car from GEICO?
I believe there is a 1 declarations page in an appendix setting that out. There is no nothing in the record that reflects any kind of a discount for a multiple vehicle or multiple policy coverage. It's simply a deck sheet setting out the coverages and the premiums.
Well, would it be intuitively correct that if one goes to a single agent and buys 3 policies on vehicles from 1 agent and 1 company, that saves money over going to 3 different agents and buying 3 separate policies on 3 household vehicles?
I don't believe that's intuitively correct, Your Honor.
Okay. But the record doesn't speak to that either way.
It does not, Your Honor.
Okay.
There are 7 general principles of underinsured motorist law that provoke the analysis in this case and the subsequent holding. First is the legislative intent of Section 3902 for years, over 20 years, has been recognized to protect innocent victims from impecunious tortfeasors, such as my client, Bromstead Deterk. Secondly, and that policy and intention of the statute has been recognized in several cases of this court, namely Frank, the Hearst decision, and Deptula. Secondly, the recognized public policy of this entire statute is full recovery of the victim. It's a very, very broad public policy, and the intent of the statute is very broad.
Can we, just to interrupt at this point, I understood your answer to the earlier question was that the language of the policy, which reads on this case and that would prohibit stacking, is void. That is, that language is void because it violates public policy.
Correct, Your Honor.
By public policy, do you mean that it's in conflict with the statute or that it's in conflict with just a notion that, that public policy is lending itself to greater coverage?
It's in contradiction to the stated public policy behind 3902 and the intent of 3902, which is full recovery.
Conflict with 3902. Is that correct?
I think the language is in conflict with 3902 because it restricts full recoveries of a policyholder.
As interpreted by the Superior Court. Aren't the language of the statute and the language of the policy, aren't they very close?
Yes, Your Honor.
If not identical?
Correct, Your Honor.
Are you suggesting 3902C is in conflict with the purpose behind 3902?
I think 3902C, by the legislative intent of the amendment, applies simply to stacking to trigger. It does not apply to post-triggering stacking for coverage, which is what the Bromstead Deterk case is.
But we don't look at legislative intent unless we find the language of the statute to be ambiguous. So the questions from the court are, if we look at the language of the policy, and we look at the language of this statute, they seem very similar. So how can the policy violate the statute if the language tracks each other?
The whole goal of statutory construction and a strict reading of a statute is to foster the legislative intent of the statute.
You never get the legislative intent unless the statute is ambiguous. So is it your position that the statute is ambiguous?
Your Honor, the Hearst case in which Your Honor authored the opinion, Hearst versus Nationwide, which is the set-off against...
I remember it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor clearly explained in that case, when that case overruled the Kenner decision, that there are cases where even in the face of unambiguity, that if the language of the policy is contrary to the legislative intent and the public policy, this court can declare it null and void.
But that's Justice Holland's point. How can you make the case that the language in the policy is contrary to the legislative intent when it's entirely consistent with an unambiguous statute?
I can take another position to answer that question, Your Honor. Simply by virtue of the fact that State Farm has a different reading of the application of 3902C, and Bromstead Deterk, we have a separate reading of it or application
of
it.
Triggering, non-triggering argument. You better get to that because otherwise I'm left in this position I just suggested by the question I asked, that it's very difficult to construe the policy as void as against public policy when it's entirely consistent with the language of the statute.
Simply by the fact that this statute is being read two different ways by the two different parties, that is an ambiguous statute. If the statute is ambiguous, then this court must rule in favor of my client as the policyholder. It must be construed in her favor.
All right, how would you construe the statute that would allow stacking in this case?
3902C does not apply in my case, the Bromstead Deterk case, to post-triggering stacking. It simply applies on the underinsured issue, which triggers the coverage. And the legislative history of the statute ratifies that. In 84, when the statute was amended, the synopsis of the amendment says that this amendment was intended to fix the inequity in the statute in defining underinsured motorist coverage. 3902C has the limited application on triggering, not on post-triggering stacking for total coverage.
Well, that's what you need to explain to me. I hear the words, but I don't get it. Why do you say that?
Under the statute, there are basically three different categories of claimants. One would be the uninsured, which is the case like the Frank case and the Hearst case. Those plaintiffs were hit by uninsured tortfeasors. That's the first class, and that's easier. Then there are the definitional sections of 3902 that make a driver qualify to trigger the underinsured motorist coverage. And in order to do that, you have to exceed the coverage of the tortfeasor. And there are all of these triggering cases that have grown up, and which is why the 3902C was amended, because in that tension, in all of these cases, triggering the underinsured motorist coverage, that's when 3902C was passed to clearly identify what would trigger the coverage, when it would apply as an underinsured.
Okay, but doesn't the statute say that when you have three policies from the same company covering someone involved in an accident, here there's no argument that underinsured motorist coverage in one policy was triggered. Everybody concedes that. State Farm gave you full benefit of the maximum amount available under one policy, but doesn't 3902 go on to say it doesn't trigger all three policies, it just triggers the highest amount among the three?
Only if the court rules that 3902C applies to post-triggering stacking. It does not prevent it if it has limited application to the triggering issue.
Well, how would you read it to be consistent with the limited application that you advocate?
That 3902C applies simply to the triggering issue, whether or not a vehicle is underinsured.
What is the language that suggests that from this 3902C?
The synopsis of the amendment that was passed in 1984.
In other words, not the plain language of 3902C as we read it in the code today.
It is not, Your Honor. So
just to clarify where we are, I understand, and tell me if this understanding is incorrect, that what we have here is policy language that prohibits stacking. Policy language is essentially identical with the language of the statute. Your argument is that the statute must be construed to allow stacking. Therefore, so must the policy language. Is that a correct statement of your position?
I would adjust that a little bit differently, Your Honor.
That's a yes or a no?
That is a no. There are two.
We have two separate issues. One issue being the language of the policy, and secondly, the language of the statute.
Correct, Your Honor.
They don't both turn on the one issue dealing with the appropriate construction of the statute.
The disposition of each issue can, and I'll explain. Because the statute, my position is it's limited in its purpose and application, and it violates the stated precedent of this court, the statute has limited application. Once that's resolved, does the policy language in all of these three policies violate the stated public policy of full recovery and the legislative intent of the statute? And based on Frank, Hearst, Deptula versus Horace Mann, the language of the policy violates that full recovery.
If we construe the statute as you were arguing, that disposes of this case, does it not?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
And the reason it does is that the policy language, which is, if it is identical with the statute, would have to be construed the same way. And if it isn't the same, then the policy language has to give way to the statute as construed by this court. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor.
What does the phrase "the affording of insurance" mean to you as it appears in 3902C?
issuing a policy of insurance for underinsured motorist coverage, such as was done in this case by State Farm under three policies.
Okay. Then what does the language, shall not exceed the highest limit of liability applicable to any one vehicle?
Exactly the interpretation and the basis for the motion to dismiss in Superior Court, the way State Farm applies the statute, to only have access to one policy as opposed to three.
Okay, but your position is 3902C doesn't apply to this case.
Correct.
Could you explain a circumstance under which 3902C would apply to a different case under your interpretation of it?
Yes. Not a post-triggering stacking case, but I can illustrate how 3902C is intended to apply. It's intended to apply consistent with this court's decision in Colonial versus Ayers, which stands for the proposition that you can't stack policies to trigger. That's where 3902C is applicable. That's exactly the kind of case that it applies.
So give us some numbers. We've got an accident, and we've got the underinsured motorist has $15,000 in coverage, and the victim has three policies. Give me some numbers that you could explain how 3902C would have any meaning.
Let me use a case that was cited by the defense, which was actually Justice Ridgely's decision in from the Superior Court. The case is Justice versus Colonial. In that case, the tortfeasor had $15,000 of coverage. The justices had two separate policies, $15,000 each. Colonial versus Ayers would take the position that you don't qualify. You're not underinsured because you have to have more coverage than the tortfeasor has. In that case, even though Justice Ridgely ruled in that case that they could stack those two policies to trigger, the later decision in Colonial versus Ayers prevents that. So you can't stack those two $15,000 policies to make $30,000 to trigger because the tortfeasor has $15,000.
And that's what you say 3902C says and nothing more.
Correct, Your Honor.
But that case at least has a reference to 3902C that when the statute prohibits stacking, that's a different story.
But the limited application of that was a stacking issue to trigger underinsured motorist coverage. One of the things, another thing that I think gives credence to my client's argument that 3902C has the limited application is the legislative history and the tension in the cases that grew up after underinsured motorist coverage was added to the statute in 1982, and then an amendment was made basically converting 3902 to excess coverage once you trigger. Part of the problem with this statute, as amply illustrated in a law review article that was written by Justice Berger's former law clerk, talked about the tension in our statute and why we've had so many confusing issues, is we have a hybrid statute. It appears to be gap coverage on triggering and excess post-triggering. And there's that tension in the middle. However, the way the amendments grew up and 3902C amendment in 1984, especially because the synopsis of the statute or the piece of legislation from the legislature says that statute was being passed to create an inequity in defining underinsured motorist law. That's the triggering. And I think that is the best support that 3902C has very limited application in this case.
Now, the Superior Court rejected that argument or did not address it?
The Superior Court rejected that argument, Your Honor. And the Superior Court cited Your Honor's case for the general rule that stacking is prohibited except where expressly prohibited by statute. It would cite it for the general rule. But that wasn't the application in Justice versus Colonial. The Superior Court also relied on Justice Johnson versus Colonial, a 97 decision. But Johnson versus Colonial was an uninsured motorist case. There wasn't a triggering issue or a post-triggering issue. Bromstead-Deterk is a post-triggering issue. Johnson versus Colonial, and actually, with all due respect to the Superior Court, was a wrong decision. It was an uninsured motorist case where there isn't the triggering issue, and that case, which was decided in 97, was actually controlled by the holding in Frank versus Horizon, and that was ignored. The second case that the Superior Court relied upon was Lewis versus American Independent. That case doesn't control the Brumstead Deterre case because it was a triggering case. The tortfeasor had underlying coverage, and the issue before the Superior Court in Lewis was whether or not the underinsured motorist coverage was triggered under one policy with two vehicles. Not the case at all in this case.
You're into your rebuttal time. Did you want to save the balance?
Yes, I will. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, members of the court. State Farm is the appellee in this case, and in the court below, State Farm moved to dismiss the case. And although it did move to dismiss the case, it did enter into a stipulation with counsel as to what the various policies were, what they provided. And in the motion to dismiss, at one of the footnotes, we referenced the fact that all three of the policies were policy number 9808.5. We attached certified copies of the declaration pages of all three of the policies, which ensured a ...2001 Saab, a 1994 Acura Legend, and a 1994 Ford Explorer. And each one of the declaration pages appended to the motion to dismiss actually makes reference in the text of the motion to policy number 9808.5. Not the text of the motion, the text of the certificate, the declaration page. So when the plaintiff says that I don't know what the other policies say, the motion itself says that each policy is the same, and so we simply appended one policy. It was never raised below. The State Farm policy, as the court has pointed out, actually tracks the language of Section 3902C. In 1989, February 16, 1989, this court addressed the Frank versus Horizon case, where it said essentially that the other motor vehicle exclusion in the Horizon policy for non-owned vehicles was invalid. However, it also addressed the question of 3902C as it existed in 1989. In 1989, if you had one vehicle in each policy, insured one vehicle, then you could stack the coverages. However, if there was one policy which insured multiple vehicles, you could not. And so essentially the court said that we have to follow what the statute says, and it took it literally. Now, back at that point, some insurers would insure five vehicles by issuing five separate policies. Some insurers would insure those same five vehicles under one policy. So there was a dichotomy there, because even though it was the same insurer, and even though one insurer issued one vehicle, one policy for five vehicles, and the other insured the same five vehicles for five policies, one could stack and one could not. As a consequence, the legislature took that matter up in June of 1989 and appended to the appellee State Farm's appendix at B-26 is the Senate bill. And the Senate bill of June 6, 1989 says presently there's an inequity in the code defining underinsured and uninsured motor vehicle benefits between policies and insuring multiple motor vehicles, and those policies insuring only one vehicle. And this bill limits that inequity. Now, since this court had issued the Frank case only 3 months earlier, and it addressed that very same point, and that come June 1989, this bill authored by Senator Minner says, let's address that inequity. What other inequity could it be addressing but the inequity pointed out by the Frank versus Horizon case? This bill is an anti-stacking bill in its entirety. It isn't limited to related insurers. It isn't related to members of the household. This is an anti-stacking bill, which would have eliminated that in its entirety. However, that is not the bill that was eventually passed, because later on that month, on June 30, 1989, the amendment became the bill that was eventually passed, which essentially said that it didn't make any difference whether there were multiple policies or single policies. It says that when two or more vehicles owned or leased by persons residing in the same household are insured by the same insurer or affiliated insurers, the limits of liability shall apply separate to each vehicle as stated in the declaration sheet, but shall not exceed the highest limit of liability applicable to any one vehicle. Now, in the synopsis, it says this amendment will narrow the scope of the legislation in accordance with the original intent of the sponsor. So, essentially, it went back to what the Frank versus Horizon court said, which is, let's deal with the issue whether you have an insurer or related insurers, people of the household. So the original bill went too far, and the subsequent bill came back to that point. That bill was eventually signed by the governor on March 19, 1990. The briefing below really simply dwelled on, at least from the plaintiff appellant's point of view, on the concept of 3902 and all the cases that have been decided by this court over the course of time. The statute itself, 3902, I'm just taking the general broad statute, doesn't refer to stacking or anti-stacking in any way, shape, or form, at least not until 3902C came to be. And as the court progressed over the course of time, the court read the policies that were issued pursuant to that statute, and the court made public policy decisions. And it became clear over the course of time that the concept was protect the innocent victim, and let's not restrict anything beyond what the policy will allow. So it became an issue at some point, is the policy personal to the insured or is it personal to the car? The decision then became it's personal to the insured. It is not vehicle-oriented. Fine. The question then became which vehicle can stack under insured coverages? Does it have to be the vehicle that you're in or another vehicle? The question, the answer was it can be any vehicle. And once the coverage is triggered, you can then stack all the multiple policies. The idea that the General Assembly responds to this court is not new. Obviously, it does it generally in multiple litigations. It did it before 1989 in the case of Hollowell versus State Farm, because at that point, the UM statute did not include any underinsured coverage. Back at the time of the Hollowell case in 1982, the argument was made that if once the tortfeasor's limits were over or were done and paid, that therefore the vehicle became uninsured. And the court at that point said that may make sense and it may be logical. However, it's not what the statute says.
As I understand the appellant's argument, 3902C is limited so that to this very purpose, that you cannot stack policies to trigger underinsured coverage, and that's all it's intended to do. What's your response to that?
My response to that is that the General Assembly would have had to be fairly inarticulate for that to have been the intent, based upon what it actually did say its intent was, because the intent was simply to deal with the inequity of the multiple policy issue, which had been decided by this court only 3 months earlier. And when it eventually passed the statute, as I said, the Senate went further and the actual statute came back to that point. That's all that was said. There's nothing in this about triggering. In fact, triggering really wasn't an issue back in the 1980s. It became an issue in the 1990s. Your Honor issued the Justice versus Colonial case where Your Honor predicted that you could combine the policies to trigger. And, of course, by the time of the Ayers versus Colonial, this court said that you cannot. But triggering wasn't an issue back in 1989, and there are no cases back from that time even talking about that issue. As I said, it became an issue much later in the year, in the late 90s and early 2000. And I can't imagine that the legislature was worried about an issue that simply nobody else was worried about at that point.
Can I ask what your position would be if instead of State Farm being the company that issued all of these policies, if there had been three separate unrelated insurers who had issued policies with the same language that is being relied on here?
Your Honor, if the General Assembly had passed the Senate bill that was proposed on June 6, 1989, my answer would be that you could stack that you couldn't stack them, because that's what that was, an anti-stacking provision. But the bill that was eventually passed, which spoke of affiliated or related insurers or the same insurer, then the answer is if there are three different policies issued by three different insurers And going back to the Frank case, which says essentially we're going to read this statute literally, there are three policies, three different insurers, and you may stack them, yes.
So this particular plaintiff gets $100,000 of coverage instead of $300,000 of coverage because State Farm got the benefit of issuing all three of those policies and getting premiums on each one of those, whereas by going to the additional effort of going to two other companies and presumably on this record paying very close to or the same rates, there would have been triple the amount of coverage.
Well, I guess the answer to that, Your Honor, is that what State Farm did was it followed the statute that had been passed for that very purpose. It simply issued a policy that was applicable to 3902C. But in response to a question that Justice Holland asked, we never explored below what the policies would cost if they were three separate policies or all one policy. However, Your Honor asked whether it's intuitive that if a person insures multiple policies under the same vehicle, that the premium would be lower. And the answer is yes, that is intuitive. We're all insured by some policy or another, and I assume all those policies contain either multiple car discounts, safe driver discounts, long-term policyholder discounts. They hold discounts because you take a safe driving course, and I've only touched upon some of those discounts. And one of them is multiple vehicle discounts.
So the economic issue that you just described and was alluded to by the Chief Justice earlier is intuitive.
Yes.
And although there's no record one way or the other, is that intuition carried out in the way insurance policies are priced?
If you're asking for my opinion, I would say yes, that's so. Because the policies, you simply don't take an amount, let's say $50, for whatever the coverage is, whether it be for no fault or liability or anything, and not record either A, how many vehicles there are, who you're insuring, whether you're insuring somebody who's 61 and has been driving for 50 years, or you're insuring somebody who's younger and been driving for a year.
Let me rephrase my question.
Okay, maybe I didn't understand it. I'm sorry.
To make it a little bit more pointed, may we suppose that the legislature, in distinguishing between the two cases where three cars are insured by the same insurer on the one hand and where the same three cars are insured by three different insurers on the other, would justify the variation in the result by the cost, by the difference in cost?
Well, the premiums have to be approved by the Department of Insurance. The insurers don't pick these at random and then hope that they can squeeze them through. But I would assume that if you went to Erie Insurance Company and Colonial and Nationwide and you insured a separate vehicle with each, that they would treat you simply as a person insuring one vehicle, and each one would treat you exactly that way without considering the fact that you insured another vehicle with someone else. But the premiums, I'm suggesting, Your Honor, the premiums do account for the fact that you insure one vehicle or five vehicles or 10 vehicles, to include, of course, and when you insure a vehicle, they ask you who's going to drive this vehicle and where are you going to drive that. Is this vehicle used for and the homeowner use? Is it driven to work? Is it driven 10,000 miles a year? Is it driven 50,000 miles a year?
Well, let me approach this from a slightly different perspective. There's been a concern, the overall public policy of full compensation and providing for people who get in accidents with others who don't have adequate insurance, that's kind of a given. And wouldn't you agree that the average purchaser of car insurance is not likely to be cognizant of the distinction between getting insurance by three different companies versus getting insurance from one company as it applies to underinsured motorists?
Your Honor, that comes pretty close to the concept that's discussed from time to time about the concept of reasonable expectations. But there are plenty of decisions from this court saying that if there's no ambiguity in the statute, that you don't have to apply reasonable expectations.
Well, for example, isn't there something that requires the insurer to offer underinsured coverage beyond the minimum, and if they fail to offer it, then it's deemed that they did offer it, something like that?
Well, you're talking about the Arms versus State Farm cases and other cases like that. You're obligated, the concept, and this is addressed most clearly in the Frank versus Horizon case, where it talks about the concept of UM coverage mirroring the liability coverage. That's actually what the language of the case says. You're obligated to offer uninsured, which by its terms includes underinsured coverage, equal to the limits of the liability coverage. So if the liability is $100,000 and the uninsured motorist is $15,000, if you don't make that offer, it's a continuing offer until it's chosen to be accepted, whenever it's chosen to be accepted. But that's not the issue here because the coverages are equal to each other.
Right, but I'm trying to get to the principle that underlies it more than the specific application. And it seems to me that the principle that underlies it is the idea that people are expecting a level of coverage that maybe they don't realize they're not getting.
I don't see that as the issue, Your Honor. If you go and insure a vehicle with, we'll make it the Hartford for the purpose, and you insure five vehicles, and you talk to the agent, and you have a discussion with the agent, that agent says, I'm going to give you, based upon what you want, here's the premium for $100,000 in UM coverage, and you have just insured five vehicles. I don't imagine any insured walks out of there and says to his spouse, good news, I've just gotten $500,000 in coverage. Each person walks out and says, I have $100,000 coverage on each one of these vehicles and whatever other coverages they purchase. And I think that's the issue here. When the Bromstead the Turks walked out of the office, they walked out with $100,000 in UM coverage for each one of these vehicles and a premium
right,
to be paid.
I understand that, but we have to assume that when the person goes in and discusses their policy, the insurance company representative doesn't say, you know, by the way, you're getting $100,000 of regular coverage, liability coverage, and UM on each of your cars. But just want to let you know, if you did it with separate companies, then you could stack your coverage. There's those kind of discussions just don't happen, right?
I can't imagine anybody would be telling them to go buy somewhere else.
Right. So in other words, from the perspective of the driver, the insured, they don't realize the pretty severe consequences of using one insurer instead of several.
Well, Your Honor, they don't understand the consequences. They may not understand that it costs more to insure it that way. But how do you solve that problem? The General Assembly decided back in 1989, and actually earlier, given the 1984 amendments, that an insured could go to an insurer and purchase multiple vehicles, and that the policies would contain the language that 3902C provides. And how do you do that? Do you enact a 3902D, which says essentially don't forget to tell the insured that they may shop around and buy different vehicles, and while it may cost them, different insurance policies, and while it may cost them more initially, it may make them more at the end. I mean, I don't know that the court needs to go that far. The General Assembly has gone as far as it chooses. And as Justice Holland said earlier, you don't have to interpret the statute if there's no ambiguity to it. And that's what we're here about. The policy and the statute track each other. What State Farm did was it enacted it put together a policy which tracked what 3902C says. Does it have to go any further?
At least as I understand the argument, both sides are saying there's nothing ambiguous about the statute. Yeah. The appellant's saying it's perfectly plain 3902C doesn't apply. And you're saying it's perfectly plain 3902C does apply. The mere difference in interpretation doesn't create an ambiguity.
Well, and that's true. That's absolutely true. But, you know, if you read the briefs below in the Superior Court, the briefing actually dwelled on the concept of 3902. I'm talking about the plaintiff appellant's brief. There was actually no discussion in the briefs below about 3902C. It was mentioned in the oral argument. Judge Cooch was a bit miffed that there was no attempt to distinguish the Lewis and the Justice and the other case escapes me at the moment, the Justice, the Lewis, and the Johnson cases. And then they're really actually only mentioned in passing in this court. The concept that the plaintiff is trying to espouse is that generally there's a right to stack, and that's the end of the matter. But that's not the end of the matter. 3902C speaks not only to the multiple vehicles, but it also says, as Justice Steele said, that you can't pay more than the limits of any one of the vehicles, the highest one. And that's what State Farm did. Now, they did tend to be all the same amount, but if the policies had been in different amounts, State Farm would have been obligated under that statute to pay the highest amount, and that's what it did. It really was obligated to do nothing else, and there was nothing else it could have done. And to explore the question about whether premiums are different or whether the reduction in the premium is enough to account for that, as Justice Berger talks about, I mean, if the premium would have been, and I'm just going to pick this figure, let's say the premium would have been 100 for one policy at, under the circumstances of all policies being insured by the same vehicle, and then you'd go on to Nationwide and they say, I'll charge you 150, and Allstate says, I'll charge you 175, and State Farm says, I'll charge you 200. How does one make the determination that the extra premium justifies what happens down the road as opposed to the lesser premium when you purchase the one policy with the multiple vehicles? If the legislature says you must inform people of that, then you must. But that's not what happened here, and that's not the issue back in 1989.
Well, is it fair to say that the policyholders are informed of what they're buying because of the anti-stacking provision in the policy itself?
Yes.
The Reformation cases, as I recall them, occurred in fact situations where there was no explanation given to people about the applicability of their BI maximum that they made available to others to underinsured that they could purchase for themselves.
That is quite
here. We don't have that absence of information.
We do,
and I think still under the common law, there's some assumption that people do read the contracts they enter into.
Several of the cases that were addressed in the briefs, I think one was the Colonial case and the other was the, it may have been the Hollowell case, I can't remember exactly, but several of the cases say there's an obligation on the part of the insured to read the policy. It isn't a question of, and I taken a deposition earlier this week where the insured said, I didn't read the form, I didn't read the policy, and I asked why, they said we just never got around to it. There is an obligation to read it. Now, I'm not suggesting that the policies are always easy to read, but they're there. The policy contains an anti-stacking provision. It contains other provisions, and you're obligated to read it. You just simply can't say, I didn't bother to read it. It's your responsibility.
Does
on the issue that Your Honor talked about.
Does the record reflect whether, first of all, the language of the policy and 3902C are comparable, if not identical? Is that correct?
That is true, Your Honor.
Does the record reflect which came first? In other words, was this policy language in existence and then the statute was amended to include that, or the policy language was not in existence and then policies were amended after the statute?
Your Honor, as I was sitting listening to Ms. Bowe argue the point, that thought occurred to me too. And I can't honestly answer it. I do know that the original State Farm policy that I started working with years ago was 9808.1. And now we're up to, I think, 0.6. So I believe, but it's not a record, and I wouldn't swear to it, that I believe this policy language was actually added later after 1989. I could track them back, but I can't honestly tell you that I know for a fact that's so, but I believe that to be so.
In any event, the record is silent on that.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Okay. Your Honor, the court have any other questions of me? Because I think I'm finished at this point.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
On the issue of intuitive, what is intuitive to the consumer in Delaware who purchased this insurance is if that you buy three insurance company policies, you will get the benefit of three insurance policies. That is intuitive. Insurance contracts are adhesion contracts. And
well, your argument would say that this policyholder should get more than the benefit they bargained for. Presumably, they paid for a policy consistent with the language of the policy, which would mean you don't stack three $100,000 limits together to make a limit of $300,000. What would have led this consumer to believe that they consumers to believe that they were purchasing more than the policy said they were receiving?
Because they had three separate contracts that they paid three separate premiums for. On the issue of the reformation...
Well, do you think they would have paid the same premium if State Farm agreed to stacking as opposed to putting in the policy a clear statement that State Farm would not be stacking those three $100,000 BI limits for purposes of underinsurance? Would they have paid the same premium, do you think?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Well...
All I know is that there are three
premiums.
You pay
at the grocery store the same price for three apples as you pay for one?
Because this is an adhesion contract, the cases of Mason versus USAA and Knapp versus USAA reformed underinsured motorist policies, even in the face of the fact that the policyholder did not read the policies. They're adhesion contracts. And when there has to be a construction, it's construed in favor of the policyholder. On the other issue raised by Mr. Schonk, he did mention that the broader draft of the 3902C amendment was not passed by the General Assembly. The draft that was actually passed by the General Assembly was much more narrow, which is evidence that it was meant to be narrowly applied. The mirror image rule that Mr. Schonk talked about, the mirror image applies to the offer. The mirror image, as far as a recovery, was stricken in Hearst overruling Kenner when this court ruled that you set off against damages and not the policy limit. So the mirror image doesn't apply when you're talking about post-triggering, and defining underinsured motorist means triggering. That's what I mean when I say trigger. It means defining.
Does the word trigger or triggering or any phrase in using that term appear in the synopsis or the bills that were introduced and passed?
It does not, Your Honor.
Well, can you respond to Mr. Schock's argument that actually triggering was not on anybody's mind at that time frame?
That was the period of time when the body of law was growing up under who is underinsured. When do you access your coverage? That's triggering. That body of law was developing over all of that time, which led in the Colonial versus Ayers opinion, which says you can't stack the trigger. Justice Berger explained that protection means compensation, and also in the Hearst opinion, she explained that you can't, Her Honor explains that you can't parse each section or subsection of the statute for literal application if it violates the intent of 3902 in the public policy of full recovery. So it doesn't matter that it didn't specifically address triggering the 1990 amendment, I believe that was the year that 3902C was passed, simply arose out of the post-Frank discussion. Even though Frank was a UM case, there was more than one UM policy, and they were actually allowed to stack. After that erupted this amendment, which is part of what the legislative history is that supports our interpretation that it has limited application.
On your issue that 3902C only applies to triggering, how is this language consistent with that? The affording of insurance under this section to more than one person or to more than one vehicle shall not operate to increase the limits of the insurer's liability. How does that apply just to triggering?
It's only intended to apply to what qualifies as an underinsured motorist, which is the triggering issue.
And language that says shall not operate to increase the limit of the insurer's liability doesn't mean anti-stacking?
We're not asking to increase the limit, Your Honor. Just acknowledge there are three policies, three premiums, three coverages on but $100,000 each.
Okay.
I respectfully request this. Sorry.
Go ahead. And finish your time's up, that's all.
Thank you. I respectfully request this honorable court rule in favor of Bromstead de Turk and hold that 3902C has limited application on the issue of what is an underinsured vehicle and reverse the Superior Court decision.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for a very interesting argument. We'll recess and take the case under advisement.